So the president of the United States is an anti-American incompetent. The Democrat frontrunner is a corrupt liar. The Republican frontrunner is a fascist blowhard. The media wouldn't know the truth if it bit them on the leg, and the Islamists are trying to kill us. But don't panic. Just file in an orderly manner toward the exits, then calmly run for your life. Trigger warning. I'm Andrew Klavan, and this is The Andrew Klavan Show. Man, I am so glad it's Christmas because if I didn't have something higher to think about than the political scene, I would blow my mind. I mean, it's a, the thing that's great about Christianity in moments like this is that if you summed up the philosophy of Christianity in a couple of sentences, it would be the world is a terrible place run by Satan. Humans are corrupt and wicked, and any person who's good enough gets martyred and then crucified. Rejoice. That's the Christian worldview. It's just this mindless happiness in the midst of all this terror. So that's what I'm going to cling to that as we go forward. Also in Hollywood, Christmas is the wonderful time when we celebrate the pious and religious ritual of watching screeners. Because if you are in the movie business at all, they send you all the movies free at the end of the year. So you can vote on them and give them, awards for best screenplay or whatever it is that you are, that is your field. So at the end of the year, I watch all the movies and I catch up with everything and I get to recommend stuff that maybe you wouldn't see. So last night I watched Legend, which was about the Cray brothers, who were two twin gangsters who ruled London in the 60s. When I lived in London, they were still legendary. I think one of them may have died while I was there, in fact. And it's played, it's kind of a wonderful piece for Tom Hardy because he plays both brothers. And Hardy, I think at this point, is really one of our great actors. He is just terrific and he's great in both parts and he really brings a philosophy. You can see him thinking, he brings a philosophy to both parts. And it's written by Brian Helgeland, I think that's how you pronounce his name. Absolutely. He's a good director. He's a great writer. He wrote L.A. Confidential, and he wrote Man on Fire. Mystic River, he wrote. I think he's just a really terrific writer, and he wrote this. And I would say it's a very intelligent gangster movie. It may not be as viscerally exciting as Black Mass was, but very intelligent, very different. And it does have a scene. One of the brothers, Ron Cray, was a psychopathic homosexual. And he had all of these members of parliament were part of his pedophile ring. And so instead of prosecuting these gangsters, when they wanted to prosecute these gangsters, they couldn't do it because he would have exposed the entire government as sleeping with little boys. So they let these guys take over London, basically, to keep from exposing themselves. It almost makes you feel that pedophiles are not as nice people as you want to think that they are. But anyway, if that makes you, if you're thinking that our government is in a bad shape, well, you're right, but it also just goes to show that the British government was also in bad shape and that government is just, it just be like that, okay? Which brings us to the news of the day, because we're talking, yesterday I was pointing out that the events of, in the way that the left and Obama are dealing with Islamism reminds me of Mars Attacks. What happened yesterday with Donald Trump reminds me of another movie, a famous classic movie, and I'm going to make the case that Hollywood has essentially predicted the existence of Donald Trump in this great film. First of all, let me begin where I ended off yesterday. It's a theory I have about what we're seeing, that we're seeing the death of a bad idea. We're seeing essentially the death of postmodernism, relativism, moral relativism, and multiculturalism that grows out of moral relativism. And I'll speak about that a little bit more. But when we saw Obama speak, and we saw what an empty, empty response this was to this moment of crisis, this moment of jihad, this thing that is actually happening now on our home soil, it just signaled to me that this idea was reaching its end point. Bret Stephens, one of my favorite columnists, the foreign policy writer for the Wall Street Journal, wrote a terrific column this morning called Fighting Terror Through Self-Reproach, in which he just takes Obama to task. And just to read a small part of it, he says, by now, We are familiar with the cast of Mr. Obama's mind. He does not make a case. He preaches a moral. He mistakes repetition for persuasion. He does not struggle with the direction, details, or trade-offs of policy because he's figured them all out. His policies never fail. It's our patience that he finds wanting. He asks not what he can do for his country, but what his country can do for him. And what's that? It's for us to see what has long been obvious to him, like an exasperated teacher explaining simple concepts to a classroom of morons. That's us. That's why nearly everything the president said last night, he has said before and in the same shop-worn phrases. His four-point strategy for defeating ISIS is unchanged. His habit of telling us and our enemies what he isn't going to do dates back to the earliest days of his presidency. His belief that terrorism is another gun control issue draws on the deep wells of liberal true belief, his demand for symbolic congressional authorization, on and on. And finally, he says the more grating parts of Mr. Obama's speech came when he touched on the subject of Islam and Muslims. We cannot, he intoned, turn against one another by letting this fight be defined as a war between America and Islam. Terrorism, as Obama sees it, is to be feared less for the harm it causes than for the overreaction it risks eliciting. This is the president as master of the preemptive self-reproach, the suggestion that Americans are always on the verge of returning to the wickedness whence we came. But since when have we turned against one another or defined the war of terror as a war on Islam? Well, since yesterday, when Donald Trump supplied the straw man that Obama is making of all of us. Obama is constantly accusing us of being these small-minded, irrational, nasty. The things he says, even overseas, he talks about Americans, you know, how small-minded we are, how bigoted we are. Donald Trump has rushed into the fray to provide him with the real life, the straw man come to life, like in The Wizard of Oz, which is not the movie I'll be talking about, but it is a little bit like that. He is Obama's straw man come to life. So what is this idea that I see dying, this relativist idea? Because remember, the things that the left says make sense. They just happen to be wrong, okay? And this the idea is that there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. That's in Hamlet. Shakespeare predicted we were going to get to this point, and I've talked about this a lot before. It really arises from the moment when Jesus confronts Pontius Pilate, and Jesus says, "I am the truth, and I speak the truth," and Pilate says, "What is truth? Who knows what truth is? You know, you can't possibly know." Now, if you follow that idea, if no one has moral truth, then every culture and every idea is exactly the same, morally. It's exactly the same. And that means if one culture rises above another culture, the only reason can be because it oppressed them, it abused them, it had a more powerful military. It can't be because in the competition of ideas, our idea won, because there are no better ideas. There's nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. That idea is collapsing, okay? That idea that there are no better ideas than not, it has collapsed before. In fact, I would say that it collapsed on 9/11. If you go back and look at some of the things that people were saying on 9/11 when the towers came down, politicians were standing up in Congress saying, "We're right and they're wrong." I mean, when had you heard that? You hadn't heard that since the Cold War, since John F. Kennedy. "We're right and they're wrong." Even the screechiest feminists like Maureen Dowd were suddenly singing the praises of men because of the policemen and firemen who had charged into these burning buildings while everybody else was running to get out. They had charged in to see if they could save some lives, and many, many of them died. And suddenly Maureen Dowd remembered. She wrote a column saying, "Oh yeah, now I remember what men are for." Well, thank you, Maureen. It's really good of you. You know, but what happens in these moments of crisis, the verities, the things that we know are true, the simple things that we know are true, that we think away in our moments of comfort, suddenly come rushing back, that good is good and evil is evil, that men require honor and women need virtue, that in that our ideas are better than their ideas. The idea of freedom is better than the idea of oppression. Suddenly, these things that only intellectuals can be stupid enough to think away, and only we in the moments of comfort and richness and wealth and security can get rid of, suddenly come rushing back on us. And over these podcasts, I've been talking a lot about the moments when ideas collapse, like during the French Revolution, when suddenly they said, "We'll never be free until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest, okay? We have to get rid of Christianity. We have to get rid of the church. We have to get rid of the governing structure that's grown up out of the church. And just absolute violence ensued. World War ensued, as people forget. Napoleon took over most of Europe. And that was this moment when we saw the failure of that notion that you can sweep all these ideas away. It happened again in World War I. I talked about during my Veterans Day broadcast how in this absolute disaster with leaders of the free world making so many mistakes, this generation of men wiped out for no good reason. In the aftermath of that, it seemed that the pillars of Western civilization had fallen. It seemed like the central ideas, the things that Western civilization rests on, were no good. They'd collapsed. And that's when you started to get this kind of modernist poetry like The Wasteland and all this. And I've talked about two poets specifically, but these great minds, Wordsworth after the French Revolution and T.S. Eliot after World War I, who set about in an act of creative genius, they set about to reconstruct the Christian verities, and both of them became Christians, and both of them became conservatives, essentially, rebuilding the ideas that everyone else threw away. And these were the most, it's funny, because both Wordsworth and Eliot were the most revolutionary poets of their day. They were the guys who completely reshaped poetry. Poetry was never, if you read poetry before Wordsworth and after Wordsworth, totally different. Read poetry before Eliot and after Eliot, completely different. They just rewrote the rules of poetry, and yet they were the ones who, after dissecting everything, after breaking it all down into its component parts, started to put them back together again. And both men came back to God, and both men came back to to the idea of tradition, and both men came back to Christianity and rebuilt it. There's a line in, there's a guy named Sir James Fraser who wrote a very famous book called The Golden Bough. And The Golden Bough was an encyclopedia of mythological practices and religious rites throughout the world. And its basic premise really was to undermine Christianity. It was to say, oh, this is just another one of these mythologies. Although he didn't have the nerve to come out and say it. He just sort of implied it with this encyclopedia. But it does have, it's really a wonderful, I've only read the condensed version. It's like 11 volumes, but I've read the condensed version. But he has this wonderful line in it where he says, the world cannot live at the level of its great men. And I think, in fact, he's referring to Jesus at that point. But it certainly holds with T.S. Eliot and Wordsworth. T.S. Eliot and Wordsworth reconstructed these ideas and gave a fresh life to the basic premises of Western culture, the basic platforms and pillars of Western culture, but the rest of us sort of let them slip away. And what ultimately happened is you have this thing, I won't go into this entire history because it would take forever, but you basically reach the point in modernism where we had what was called the Great Conversation. And the idea of the Great Conversation was that there was truth out there, but you kind of reached it by half measures, like the turtle moving to the wall. You never reached the wall. You only got halfway and halfway. But you had Aristotle talk to Plato, and you had Dostoevsky talk to Nietzsche, and all the great minds of the West were in this great conversation. And by studying this great conversation, you moved closer and closer to this truth. But the basic idea underneath this, and many scholars have written about this, was that it was a godless pursuit. It was not a religious pursuit. And the reason they thought that is they thought that once you introduced religion into it, it would cut off the pathway to truth, because the whole point of the Great Conversation was all ideas were welcome, all ideas were open. And once you had this basic idea that, yes, there's a God, yes, he wants us to do certain things, and our consciences are a guide to something real and something true in heaven as they are on earth, once you have that, it cuts off thought. Now, that's a really faulty concept, because every truth limits thought. Once you know that the world is round, you can't really have a debate about whether it's flat anymore. You know, I mean, so all truth cuts off thought, and the truth of God does cut off certain kinds of thought. But I think that without God, there is no truth. And so that was the flaw in the argument. So they thought, we're in this secular idea where we're having this long debate. And in the 60s, basically, people rose up and said, well, wait a minute. Who says there's a truth? Why is the great conversation a Western conversation? Why is it Plato talking to Aristotle? Why do we even talk about Plato and Aristotle? The Greeks held slaves, you know, the Americans held slaves. Why are we even listening? You know, the British were imperialists. Why are we listening to these people? And the modernists had no answer. They had no answer because they had no God. They had no way of saying, no, there is a basic truth. They no longer had the goods, and they retreated instantly in front of this absolute swarm of leftists and postmodernists coming and saying there is no truth, there's only a narrative. And that's where this idea kind of rises up again. And so now we have the idea that there's no moral truth and no culture can be better than another. And that idea is failing. It failed on 9/11. We put it off in our Bush hatred, in our George W. Bush hatred, in our weariness with war. We kind of clung to it again. We elected Obama. He went around the world. Don't forget this. He went around the world and apologized for America after 9/11. He did. He says he didn't, but the tapes are there. He did. He went and said, it's our fault this has happened. Well, of course it's our fault. If we're the dominant culture and no idea is better than another, we must have done something wrong. We must be oppressing people. It can't just be that we won the argument of ideas, that our part in the great conversation came to the fore. It can't happen. So he went around apologizing for it, and now he looks like a fool. And you only have to look in his eyes to know he failed. You know, some people think that Obama is an incompetent, and some people think that this is what he was planning. I think both things are true. I think he thought he was going to draw America back into a smaller country, because why should we be dominant if all cultures are the same? So he's going to draw us back. But I think he thought that was going to make the world a better place. I don't think he did that out of evil, that now, you know, I'm going to draw America down into a better, into a smaller country so that Islam can take over. No, he thought that was going to make the world a more balanced place. But it's so clear now that that was not true. So what has Obama done? Obama has retreated into the final fantasy of the left, which is a world without competition, okay? Because if there's no better ideas, we don't need competition. Competition can only be a bad thing. And so he's retreated to this climate change thing where you cannot be convicted. You can't go wrong, because who's going to know whether anything he did had any effect whatsoever? So everybody gets a prize. You know, Obama just gets a prize for participating in the battle against climate change. And on this real battlefield where ideas win and lose and where soldiers win and lose, he's not playing that game whatsoever, okay? So now we've got this whole idea that competition is a bad thing and we don't have to be in any – results don't matter. But there's one place – there's one place where competition still is the American ideal, and that's on reality TV. It's on reality TV, including sports. When we watch sports, there's no, you know, nobody gets a prize for showing up. You got to win that game, okay? And people still turn on football and baseball to see who wins. And on these shows like Shark Tank, they come in and they present an idea. It's a very capitalist show. Duck Dynasty, very capitalist show. And, of course, Donald Trump's show, The Apprentice, very capitalist show about competition and who wins and why the best idea wins, okay? Now, I've never liked the word reactionary. I hate the word reactionary because they call conservatives reactionary, and the idea embedded in the word reactionary is that there's this wonderful, wonderful thing going on called social progress, and we move forward into a bright new future of utopian future, and conservatives react, and they're reactionary. Say, don't do it. But Donald Trump is reactionary. Donald Trump is a creation of the left. There's no question about it. The lies that we've been told, the idea that we can't say the word Islam, that the, you know, when we talk about terrorism, the idea that everything is, that there is no competition, that we don't have to compete with other countries, we just open our borders and let them all in. He is a reaction against those bad ideas. See, when they talk about reactionary, what they mean is we're reacting to good things, but Trump is reacting to really bad ideas, okay? And when we respond, we're being reactionary because we're so offended and so angry that we're being told that we can't acknowledge the truth in front of our eyes, that when a guy reaches up, speaks up, and speaks those truths, we respond to him and we rush to him. Let's get to this movie that I'm talking about, because this predicts this whole thing. The movie was called A Face in the Crowd. It was made in 1957 by a great director named Ilya Kazan. Now, I don't know, you probably haven't heard of Ilya Kazan, but the most famous thing about Ilya Kazan, aside from the fact he made classic movies like On the Waterfront and The Streetcar Named Desire, is he testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee and named names and ended the career of, I think, Paddy Chayefsky, a very mediocre leftist playwright who gets overpraised. But he ended his career. And they never forgave him for it. And it wasn't until 1999 that this great, great director was given an honorary Oscar to sort of welcome him back into the fold. And when he did, many people at the Oscars wouldn't applaud. They refused to applaud for Ilya Kazan. He made this picture called A Face in the Crowd with Andy Griffith, who later went on to play the All-American Sheriff in the Andy Griffith Show. But he started out, Andy Griffith is a very fine actor, and this was his greatest role. And in this movie, he plays a drunken wanderer who ultimately gets the name Lonesome Rhodes, I think it is. It's Lonesome Rhodes. And he plays the guitar, and he's kind of a Cracker Barrel philosopher. And this woman comes along, played by Patricia Neal. She's an ad exec or a publicist. And she realizes that this guy has talent. She puts him on a local TV show. And this local TV show takes off. And he starts delivering this Cracker Barrel wisdom on TV. And he becomes a phenomenon. Okay, so let's just take a look at the first clip from Face in the Crowd. This is his show. Now, wait, before you start it, he's delivering this Cracker Barrel wisdom. But when the lights go off and they go to commercial, you suddenly see his real character, because he's really a skunk. He's a skunk with women. He's a skunk with – he has no real belief system. He's just selling this character. So you'll hear for a moment when they go cut to commercial, you'll hear his real character come out. Let's play this clip.
You know, when we're standing there shoulder to shoulder in that cold water, belly button high, and the sun has come in and smile in on us, Curly looked at me and he says, Lonesome, the family that prays together stays together.
That's the truth.
That's what he said. I tell you, that man is an inspiration. A man among men.
The Cracker Barrel, starring that irrepressible Arkansas traveler.
You're off.
Glad that's over. I'm gonna start shooting people instead of ducks.
For relaxation and for health. The cigarette that cleans your tobacco without a filter. And by Best Friend Dog Food.
Take one.
Your dog's
Take
best
two.
Friend. And by Vitajex. That old Vitajex What You Doing To Me pill.
Well, hurry back, you all. Remember what old Uncle Lonesome said. The family that prays together stays together.
All right. The family that prays together stays together, because that's a truth. The truth of prayer, the truth of faith, is a truth that we all know. Only intellectuals can think themselves out of it. And so he's speaking the simple truth, but his character remains the character of a bum. He's a skunk. And the people are so hungry to hear that truth that they start to follow Lonesome Rhodes with an almost religious fervor. Let's take a look at another reality TV show called The Apprentice, in which Donald Trump exemplifies another basic truth.
It's over. Don't you think it's over? I mean, not just these two guys, just everybody. They just don't seem to have it.
You are going to see great successes from the men.
Well, you know, I hope I'm going to really see great successes from you, Sam, but no longer with us. You're fired. I have no choice. You're fired. Hey, for 2 weeks, you've been on the edge. You know that. But now we have to go. You're fired, Sam.
I remember that. I have no choice. I have no choice. Remember that line. The truth of competition is very deep. The truth of competition not only says that there are good ideas and bad ideas, it reminds us of where the idea of freedom that we know comes from. It really came from the scientific revolution, when Newton discovered that God's world works. God's world works. It doesn't need God to move the clouds around. You know, the world works. It doesn't need God to fix every little thing. It works. And from that idea, from Newton's vision, came other visions, like the Wealth of Nations a century later, where they thought, gee, the market works. The human world works, too. We don't need kings to mess around with every little thing. We don't need the government to adjust every little thing. The world works. When we trade with each other, it works. And so the truth of competition is just as true as the truth of prayer. And Donald Trump, in speaking that truth, remains just as creepy a guy, just as bad a guy as Lonesome Roads. Here is my friend and the brilliant Kevin Williamson from National Review speaking about Donald Trump. He says, Trump brings out two of the right's worst tendencies, the inability to distinguish between entertainers and political leaders, like in Face of the Crowd, and the habit of treating politics as an exercise in emotional vindication. That's being reactionary, what I was talking about. Whatever Trump's appeal is to the right's populist elements, it isn't policy. He's a tax-happy, crony capitalist who is hostile to free trade, but very enthusiastic about using state violence to homejack private citizens. He backed the Kelo decision, quote, 100%, and has tried to use eminent domain in the service of his own empire of vulgarity. If it's not the issues, it's certainly not the record of the man himself. Never mind that he's a crony capitalist. He's not even an especially good crony capitalist. But he speaks his mind, shout the Trumpkins. Indeed he does, in a practically stream of consciousness fashion. The value of speaking one's mind depends heavily on the mind in question, and Trump's is second rate. He was the candidate who will take the fight to Hillary, protest the Trumpkins. Maybe, maybe not. He is on the record as a supporter of Hillary, and he's not on record as a presidential candidate. This was before he filed. He'll build a wall on the border and make the Mexicans pay for it. Unlikely, says Kevin, but even if he did, half of illegal immigrants arrive not on the banks of the Rio Grande, but in the airports. And he goes on and on, just dissecting this guy. What a fake, what a fraud he is. And so his, even though he's speaking these simple truths on this show, his character remains the same. So let's see what happens now in Face of the Crowd when Lonesome Rhodes is finally given some power and his true character comes out.
The general's been talking to Fuller. He's selling him on the idea of creating a new cabinet post for me. In time of imminent crisis and danger. That's the way the general puts it. Who could rally the people better than I could? Hold them in line right behind the government. We'd put Fuller across the way. I know we're gonna. He's gonna owe me that. Secretary for National Morale. How's that sound to you, Marsha? Secretary for National Morale. General's asking Fuller to shake hands on it with me after the big banquet I'm throwing tomorrow night, launching Fighters for Fuller.
Fighters for Fuller?
Yeah, Fighters for Fuller. How you like that name, huh? 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 I made it up. Everybody's nuts about it. I got 20 of the biggest men in this country coming to my banquet tomorrow night to get Fighters for Fuller rolling. Got a retired admiral from the Joint Chiefs, two governors, some of them big investment house boys, and a cabinet minister.
Which one?
I don't know. I told the general to pick one out for me.
Are they coming to your party?
Oh, honey, if I ask them, they gotta come. Maybe they'd be afraid not to come. I could murder them. Like this.
Now let's watch the same scene when Donald Trump begins to acquire power. Go ahead.
Shall I read you the statement? Donald J. Trump is calling for, now listen, you got to listen to this one because this is pretty heavy stuff and it's common sense and we have to do it. Remember the poll numbers, 25%, 51%. Remember the poll numbers. Okay, so remember this. So listen. Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on. We have no choice. We have no choice.
Muslims, you're fired. You're fired, Muslims. You know, this is the same thing. This guy has given us a little taste of truth in his belief in competition, in his hostility toward the media, which is corrupt and dishonest, in his recognition that there is a problem with Islam. I've spoken about this, that we have to be open to asking questions about the nature of Islam and whether the cancer of violence that has grown within Islam is inherent to its philosophy. We have to be able to explore that with experts and with honest readings of the Quran and speak out on it without risking our lives. But what he's talking about, and I don't even know if it's unconstitutional, John Yoo says it is, but I don't see why it should be unconstitutional. What he's talking about is hateful and mean and wrong and un-American. He is the straw man that Obama keeps accusing the rest of us of being, and his character is despicable. Let me put it bluntly. You know, as well as being the time of Christ's nativity and the holy time of screeners coming from Hollywood, this is also the time when Washington crossed the Delaware. People remember that picture of him, but they don't really know a lot of times what happened. He had just suffered, Washington, one of the worst disasters in military history. He had just lost New York, the city of New York, to the British. He had looked through a telescope and watched as Fort Washington on the island of Manhattan had been destroyed by Hessian mercenaries. And these Hessians were just tough, mean guys who were really sent in to terrorize the Americans into surrendering. And he watched through a telescope as they bayoneted 15-year-old boys who were the only soldiers he had, and the old men who were the only soldiers he had. And then they marched the prisoners out, and they beat them as they went out and made fun of them. And the entire British army turned out to make fun of them, and they put them on prison ships where most of them died through the winter and from disease and starvation where they were mistreated. Washington left and marched his guys through the snow with the blood trailing from their feet, and in a moment of incredible courage and inspiration, turned around and crossed the Delaware and attacked a Hessian regiment. And there's this myth that they were drunk. It was Christmas Eve. And there's this myth that the Hessians were drunk. It was not true. They were ready. They knew. They had heard that the colonials might attack, and they said, let them come. Let them come. We'll take them. And Washington came over, and he captured he killed many of the Hessians, and he captured, I think, 900, I think it was. He captured a large number of the Hessians, and the first words out of George Washington's mouth, the first words were, treat the prisoners with honor. Treat the enemy with honor, because he was a Christian man, and that is our creed, and this idea that we react with anger and hatred. Forget about it. Take out a dollar bill, look at the face on that dollar bill, and be ashamed if that's what you feel. If you're cheering for this clown, this Trumpian clown, take out a dollar bill and look at the father of your country. Remember, you are a child of that father as well as a child of a father above, and be ashamed. This guy is a bad guy. He's a fascist. And we have brought these guys to the fore before, and we've always dumped them in time. Let's make sure we dump them again. If you have a chance, I would greatly appreciate it if you would go on Amazon or one of the other booksellers and pre-order my memoir, The Great Good Thing, A Secular Jew Comes to Faith in Christ. It doesn't come out till September, but it's helpful to me if you pre-order it. It helps me get deals from Amazon, and they'll sell it on at a bargain and stuff like that. Stuff I like. Christmas stuff I like. Finally, Jay Hayes, like, finally, stop talking about politics and talk about stuff I like. yesterday I came up with an excellent novel that takes place at Christmas that I'm sure most of you have never heard of. Now I've got a really good movie. There's so many Christmas movies that you've already seen, but I bet you've never seen the movie Remember the Night with Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray. Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray would go on to make one of the classic crime films of all time, Double Indemnity. Great, great crime film. But before they did this, they made this movie, which was written by Preston Sturges, who was the master of screwball comedy. And the plot is basically she's a thief and he's a DA, and she gets caught on Christmas Eve, or right around Christmas, and he realizes that no jury on Christmas is going to convict a woman. So in a cynical ploy, he basically has her trial laid over until after Christmas, and through a series of events, winds up taking her home to his country home for Christmas. And it's a very touching story, but I will bet its ending really surprises you, and every conservative who sees the end thinks, wow, that is really different, and Hollywood would not have made that film today. I'm done. Should we play a clip? Go ahead, play a clip before I'm done. Go ahead, play just a brief clip. This is
good knowledge.
Oh, Jack. Well, I haven't even started that bottle you gave me last Christmas.
Oh, out of ecstasy. That's the same kind you gave her last Christmas.
It is. They told me that was the latest.
Well, I love it.
Oh, isn't that pretty?
That's the latest too, I think.
Oh! Why, Jack Sergeant, you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Willie.
Here's
a mouth.
Oh, boy. Gee, I love Christmas.
That's the latest, Willie.
Oh, what in the world?
Oh, you got it out back?
No, huh? Willie, this way.
That's right. Well, you got yodel with it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll practice up on that later. Yeah. Oh, boy, is it snazzy. Find the mirror. Get all the stuff together. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, it's a very sweet movie. Remember the Night, and you will not guess the ending, even though it seemed like a, you know, you can guess everything in it. You will not guess the ending. I'm Andrew Klavan. This is The Andrew Klavan Show. We'll be back again tomorrow. Be here.